right, before I introduce the last two speakers, we have to clear something up here. I was roundly informed that I had to clear something up, and that is that it was Al Quie who vetoed Merla, and it was Rudy Perpich who signed it. Okay, so we all clear on that now? Okay. And yeah, the bit about the archiving, this stuff is archived, and so you can go back and look at the PowerPoints and Prezi. All right. I'm trying to think if there's any. Does anybody have any last announcements from people that know what needs to be announced? Okay. So the last two speakers, Nelson French and Mike Bars. Nelson French is the Great Lakes Superior Supervisor for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, where he's working with others to protect Lake Superior. The focus on remediation, restoration, and removal of beneficial use impairments in the St. Louis River area of concern. He joined PCA in 2011. Before that, he was Executive Director of Kinnickinnick River Land Trust in Western Wisconsin. And over the past, he's served as Executive Director for Friends of the Minnesota Valley, State Director and Vice President, Minnesota Operations of the Nature Conservancy, Executive Director of Project Environment Foundation, the organization we now know as the Minnesota Center of Environmental Advocacy. And he was part of the lobbying team that worked to enact the Minnesota Response and Liability Act, MRLA, in 1981-1983 time period. He was with the Sierra Club Project Environment, which partnered with AFL-CIO and Minnesota trial lawyers to push for passage of the Superfund law, which Rudy Perpich signed. And Mike Bars, they're going to tag team it. So he's worked at MPCA bioremediation programs for the past 27 years. How about a hand for Mike? Petroleum remediation and Superfund programs. And his work is focused on investigation and cleanup of contaminated aquatic sediments in the Duluth area since 1999. So we're going to be talking about Superfund's role in the Great Lakes Restoration St. Louis River Area of Concern project. Take it away.
Well done. Mike, you going to come up or are you going to harass me from the audience first? Okay. Well, it's wonderful to be here. I can tell stories about the 1981, 82, and 83 time period if anyone wants to spend some time on the side. One thing in particular was the group of Republicans that we got to meet with Al Quie before he vetoed the bill was rather interesting. And there are G. Robert Johnson stories. There are all kinds of Jim Payne knows some of those stories. Those were interesting times, but we won't dwell there because we're well beyond that right now and we're moving forward. The St. Louis River Area of Concern is something that is probably a mystery and perhaps one of the best-kept secrets, but I'm going to try to demystify it a little bit for you, put the system of the St. Louis River in context for you and the things that have happened over the past 25 years or so to get ready for the work we're about to do. So let me start here. First of all, since 2010, actually since 2003 or 4, starting with the Bush administration, there has been a tremendous focus to get the Great Lakes framed up much like the Chesapeake Bay. In other words, take a large systems approach towards understanding the issues, getting the resources necessary to resolve those issues. And in doing so, we've now, I think I was just at a conference in D.C. about 2 weeks ago, we've now surpassed where the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and those groups are in their work, in our work in the Great Lakes. Suffice it to say that a collaboration of federal agencies was put together, and with the Obama administration, the Great Lakes Restoration Collaborative turned into an initiative with a five-year plan, and it was funded. Our primary partners in the St. Louis River area of concern are the Minnesota DNR, the Wisconsin DNR, the federal agencies in particular, NOAA, the Army Corps of Engineers, EPA, Fish and Wildlife Service, and USGS. And of course, the Fond du Lac Band is a very critical partner. So this is a partnering situation. It's a bi-state area. I'm going to overview the past history of the legacy of settlement and development prior to environmental regulation and what that left us with. Then the brief discussion about the post-environmental regulation era, where we obviously, as we discussed, had Superfund, CERCLA, MRLA, the Great Lakes Collaborative, and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Then we're going to look at, Mike is going to really drill down into some of the really sophisticated system-wide remedial analysis and efforts that are underway in the St. Louis River at a scale much larger than any individual Superfund site that you may have been talking about in your discussions today. And then finally, I'll come back and kind of lay the groundwork for where we're headed over the next decade or so to get this amazing work done. So if we take a look at what happened as we settled the country, this slide just depicts the fact that the infrastructure in Duluth and the Twin Ports went in quite some time ago. The alteration of the habitat began at this time. In this graphic, we can see that there are still things that I think that are articulating wetlands in the Superior Bay there. This map was showing that the terrestrial infrastructure was going in, but we had yet to fully implement the aquatic infrastructure, which we now know as the Duluth Superior Harbor, where we have slips, which were essentially developed through dredging and or filling significant aquatic habitat. So we're looking at addressing issues that began 150 years ago, I mean, quite a while ago. By 1890, you can see that Duluth and Superior was a bustling port. The bridge isn't in yet, but the slips are sure there. And so the habitat alteration, which is part of what we're attempting to fix through our efforts here, occurred a long time ago. And then, of course, as we developed and prospered and the region grew, we know there was the timber, the minerals, and the grains that moved through the area, all causing their impacts on the system. And this is a time well before we had in our cognizance the fact that we needed to regulate or get a handle on the environmental issues related to our development. So, and of course, Michael talk a lot more about the U.S. Steel site. This previous site was the St. Louis River Interlake Duluth Tar site at the height of its operation. And we can see that was a real bustling economic area, as was the Duluth Steel Plant. In the little bit of history research I've done, it's been interesting to find out that in 1907, the state legislature actually passed a statute placing a very steep tax on the export of raw minerals from the state of Minnesota, which essentially forced U.S. Steel's hand to build a steel plant in a place where they had no intention of building it, which is at the west end of Lake Superior. So it's interesting how our policies are interwoven with decisions that end up affecting the environment. So Michael, drill down more on this. Before the area of concern was established as part of the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, we had already begun to make progress. One of my mentors and probably a good friend of at least the people who have been doing groundwater work for 35 years or more is Willard Munger, who began his efforts to clean up the St. Louis River estuary back in 1955. And it took him 25 years or 24 years to get the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District online to manage the waste coming in from the industrial and the residential communities, I think in 18 communities all the way up the river to Cloquet. So it was after this happened that the Clean Water Act, in 1987, a revision was made to what was then called the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, which introduced the concept of areas of concern. That was 1987, and a lot of things had happened over time. Again, these areas were identified across the Great Lakes in the U.S. and Canada as part of a binational agreement between the two countries. 43 areas across the Great Lakes were identified as areas where there were significant historical legacy impacts associated with high density development that impacted the ecosystem and the environment and human health. So as you look at this map of these areas, you'll see that very few of them are a surprise. We've got Milwaukee, Sheboygan, Green Bay, the Duluth Superior Harbor. And these are all areas that have been compromised because of the way in which they were developed prior to environmental regulation. So the annex identified these areas of concern as having a potential of 14 different problems, which were called beneficial use impairments, not to be confused with Clean Water Act impairments that we speak of much today. These are actually beneficial use impairments. Of those 14, the St. Louis River area of concern was found to have 9 of them. So the mission we are on is to resolve the issues that were identified associated with these 9 problems: restrictions on fish and wildlife consumption, fish tumors and other deformities, degradation of benthos, loss of fish and wildlife habitat, and degradation of fish and wildlife populations, and so on. This area of concern is the largest area of concern in the Great Lakes, and 21 of the other 26 domestic AOCs could fit within the geographic boundary of our area of concern. So the size and scope and magnitude of the site is significant, although, as you will see from Mike's presentation, much of the work is drilling down on the impacts that were that occurred in the riparian zone in and around the estuary of the St. Louis River. So basically, the description of the AOC is the lower 39 miles of the St. Louis River from Fond du Lac and Cloquet down, all of the Nemadjee watershed and portions of the North Shore South and the St. Louis River watersheds, and a portion of Lake Superior. So with all of this in mind, and the collaborative that was begun by President Bush and the initiative that was matured and funded by President Obama, starting in 2010, in that year, $475 million was appropriated for work across the Great Lakes. And every year subsequent to that, for the last four, $300 million a year has been appropriated. And Congress is discussing another 5 years. So we are on the lookout for funds to come through for the next 5 years at a minimum to fund the work in the St. Louis River AOC. And after Mike talks, we'll come back and talk a little bit about how the funding scenarios fit, how the state legacy funds and the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative funds line up in a perfect storm at this time to get work done over the next 6 to 8 years. So, but importantly, the work to clean up the St. Louis River area of concern is a top priority of the national plan. You'll see here that the national plan top three priorities are cleaning up areas of concern, reducing nutrients entering the lakes, and preventing introduction of new invasive species. So we need to strike while the iron is hot, and to date we've brought in over $40 million of resources for what I would call the prenuptials, which is getting our heads around exactly what needs to be done. So Mike, with that, I think I'll hand it over to you. We'll do questions at the end, I guess.
Thanks, Nelson. I'm going to get into what the MPCA's remediation programs have done in the AOC. First of all, we're doing a sediment characterization project of the whole 39 miles of the St. Louis River. There's a lot of data that's been previously collected, but we're going to collect more and get a good data set. Also, I'm going to talk about a couple of Superfund sites that are the main two sites in the estuary that led to a lot of these beneficial use impairments. We had some historical involvement in the AOC. In the 90s, we worked with some small projects and worked with our water staff. In 2005, we kind of developed a prototype for and a scope of work, but really didn't have the funding available to carry that out. We did some laser-induced fluorescence sampling and tried to get that started, but it wasn't until 2008 and through 2014 that the funding became available from our federal partners. By the federal partners for this work, it was the Army Corps of Engineers and the EPA's Great Lakes National Program Office administering the Great Lakes Legacy Funds. The area of concern, Nelson showed a different map of it. This shows our sediment characterization area. It's the full 39 miles of the St. Louis River. We broke it up into four sections. We had partners, two of the sections were done by Army Corps-funded contractors. Two of them were done by EPA-funded contractors. They kind of leapfrogged. We had Superior Bay, St. Louis Bay, the lower St. Louis River up to the Fond du Lac Dam. So all of those are within what we call the St. Louis River estuary. It really is controlled by Lake Superior. Above that is the stretch of the St. Louis River all the way up through Cloquet. And if many of you know, by going through areas like Jay Cook, there's not a lot of soft sediment to sample up there. So that area was focused mainly on the dams and impoundments. And there are several of them between Fond du Lac and Cloquet. So we wanted to get a strategy to get spatially diverse and consistent data set. There was a lot of other work that had previously been done to collect sediment data in the area of concern, but it was for other studies. They weren't really for the purposes of characterizing the whole AOC. So we wanted to get a complete data set, conduct a meaningful comparative analysis on a large geographic scale that would help us get a sharper focus on hotspots, on an AOC-wide basis, where do we need to do further work, and allow us to prioritize our resources for remediation and future cleanup, and also restoration activities that are outside of normal remediation projects. So to further divide that up, we divided the Minnesota side into 77 what we call remedial assessment areas. There were another 43 in Wisconsin, and for about 120 total areas that are mainly defined by geographic areas, slips, embayments, and reaches of the river. And we used historical place names for these and also have a numbering system for them. So this is these areas were all within our study, and what we wanted to do is get points in all of these geographic areas, sampling data in all of these geographic areas. So our main tool was vibrocoring. We had 8 separate mobilizations between 2008 and 2014. We also did geoprobes on barges, drill rigs on barges, the EPA's Mud Puppy 2, which could do both PONAR grab samples and other types of sampling. And we had a contractor out this summer from California who spent 3.5 weeks doing vibrocores in the St. Louis River. And it was 75 to 80 degrees, sunny every day, and it never rained, and they loved Duluth. We told them it was always like that. And then it ranged from shallow areas where we'd do push cores, and then we had a system where we devised a decision rule to determine what segments we would sample out of a core. Every core, we tried to get at least 2 samples from, a surface sample and a subsurface sample at 50 centimeters. And then we would have up to 5 samples per core, depending on whether we saw evidence of contamination or if we had very thick sequences that we were able to recover. So we collected a lot of data for this characterization project, about close to 500 locations where we took cores. So what are we doing with all this data? How do we house it and how do we use it? There was a previous database that many of you might be familiar with that Judy Crane at the MPCA put together. It was a sediment quality database or a sediment database. And it really couldn't handle all of this new data and it couldn't handle the queries that we wanted to do. So the Lake Superior unit contracted with LimnoTech and they developed a new database, or actually a new phase of that database, that has lots of specialized queries that handles calculated values, additivity, and dealing with non-detects across wide range of studies where you had lots of different detection levels, from simple solutions to more complex statistically based non-detect treatments. So this was a big database now. We wanted to find somebody to administer it. So NOAA stepped up and they, a few years ago, established the Lake Superior National Estuary and Research Reserve in Superior. And that group is now going to administer this database. And that database houses 84 separate studies, including our characterization, has 2,600 plus stations, over 6,000 individual samples, and 271,000 individual chemistry results. Our characterization effort pretty much almost tripled the chemistry results in the previous database. Then we needed to have analysis tools. How are we going to use all this data? There were queries built into the Access database itself, and we also have started using Tableau software to do our visualizations and have a graphical interface to our database where we have lots of canned queries where we can look at all of the contaminants by individual contaminants, mixtures, calculated results, compare them to different benchmarks, and have ability to choose one or multiple studies to look at. So you can slice and dice your data a lot of different ways. The main feature is you have 2 graphical portions that we've developed. One is a map view that shows the core locations, and there's a concentric circle depth key for that. And then the bottom is actually kind of a core view. You look at that, it's a 0 to 100 plus centimeters, or however thick the deepest core is. And it lets you see where you had sample intervals in an individual core and how they compare with the color schemes to different sediment quality benchmark values. So that was a great tool. LimnoTech also put together a whole series of maps in different scales to look at sliced by different depth intervals in the sediment and also by different contaminants. So this is an example of an area-wide one, the whole estuary and river through Cloquet, for lead in the upper 15 centimeters of sediment. And then the color codes are, again, sediment quality target values, red being above level 2, green being below, and yellow being in between. So anything red is really a potential problem. As for lead, you can see that it's kind of focusing on some areas like Fraser Shipyard. I guess I'll use a pointer if I've got it. Where they did shipbuilding, Minnesota Slip, where there was shipbuilding, and some other areas where you'd expect to see it. So we can look at our data through these set of maps that were developed. Also, each one of those assessment areas, LimnoTech put together a dashboard. And there's an example of one of them. It shows where the study took place and what the name of it is, what the name of that assessment area is. And it also has some core information below that. Gives you box plots with quartiles for selected chemicals. Gives you a quick count of exceedances of various threshold values and how many samples were taken in within that area and for what parameters. So it's a good way to compare each area to each area. So if you want to do a restoration project or any kind of work in one of these areas, you can pull one of these up. There's also what we call the energy guide section. It's kind of like what you do when you buy a refrigerator. You can compare your site to other sites in the estuary by where it falls within that sediment or mean potential effects concentration quotient. So it's a quick way to do comparisons between sites. So our goal with all of this information is to take each one of those assessment areas and place it in one of these three boxes. Green means that they're ready for restoration or any kind of activity. There's no or very minor issues related to contamination. Or red, the other extreme, where there's a remedial program. These go into a remedial program lead. They kind of follow the Superfund track. They have moderate to major issues, and they will go through a remedial investigation and feasibility study. The vast majority are either yellow or green in the estuary. And the yellow ones, because of that 150-plus years of industrialization, there's a lot of legacy contaminants in the sediments of the river. Not necessarily from point sources, but just sediment or contaminations that have moved around with the dynamic nature of the estuary. So those are yellow sites. And they're not to the level where it needs a remedy, but you should be aware of this if you're going to do work, especially restoration work, and make sure that you do strategic restoration to take care of that and address any of the contaminants that might be there. And we've also are putting together recommended management practices for how you would address low to moderate level contamination. Really, there's two more categories. One we call red-gray, and those are ones after our characterization. There just wasn't enough data for an individual area to make the decision whether it goes remedial route or not. And then purple are cleanups, ones that have already been completed. So if you look at the whole estuary on this map, there are 8 RIFS, or red sites, 7 additional characterization. They're shown in yellow here instead of the red-gray. Cleanup completed purple. So you'll see that one is the Inner Lake site here where the cleanup has been completed. The red and yellows are kind of concentrated in the lower harbor in slips in industrial areas. And some of the yellows go to the ponds behind Erie Pier. And then upriver in the Thompson Reservoir and the Scanlon Reservoir. A lot of the previous data collections there had trouble with some lab issues, so we needed to get more characterization there and to also look at some of the contaminants, but we just didn't have enough spatial coverage. The red areas, the remediation sites, again, are in the harbor area and surrounding U.S. Steel. It actually shows U.S. Steel on here, Munger Landing to the north of it, and Mud Lake West to the south of it. Just quickly, I don't want to dwell on this slide, but we're going to finalize these additional characterization, the red-gray sites, by spring of 2015 coming up, where we'll determine whether they go red or they go back into yellow or green. There's likely a couple of them red. We still have data trickling in from multiple labs, and we're doing the QAQC, but likely we're going to have a couple of red sites come out of this characterization. For the red sites themselves, where we knew there were issues, we basically did the remedial investigation level sediment sampling to get a full data set to do a feasibility study and a remedy if necessary. Of these 8, Minnesota Slip, we actually have a feasibility study completed on that. It's ready to go to remediation. The SLIP 2 is actually in the VIC program, and we have approved a response action plan for that site. And U.S. Steel, we're finalizing the feasibility study right now. It'll be out tomorrow in final draft form and to the public soon. And we expect to hopefully start remedy there in 2015. But all of these sites will be wrapped up with a feasibility study by spring of 2016. An example of one of these red sites, again, Minnesota SLIP. It's probably the highest contaminated red site other than U.S. Steel. It's got a long industrial history, and the core shots on the tableau view kind of show some deep and pretty heavy contamination, mainly PAHs and some metals. And there's a long industrial history here. Like I said, they have to do an RP search in order to determine whether there are RPs before we can spend federal or state money on a cleanup of the site. And there are probably over 100 potential RPs over the last 150 years that could be held as responsible parties. That's being narrowed down and screened down. But we had a shipbuilder, world's largest hardware manufacturer, a couple of foundries, and all kinds of other things going on here. The voluntary site at SLIP 2, there's a developer is putting a hotel complex in with a recreational marina. And we had some of the tableau views here don't show our new data, but we had some fairly high-level contamination here, metals and PAHs, that probably needed to be dealt with in a remedy. But they had another problem for their development. The dock walls were deteriorating, and their solution to fix it was take it from 28 feet deep up to about 10 feet deep with other harbor dredge material to stabilize the lower part of the dock wall. That would take care of their problem for dock wall stability, but would also cap any contaminants under 10 to 15 feet of new sediment. So we said that that would act as a remedy. We signed a response action plan for them to do that work. They hoped to have started this fall. They have some issues with getting material from the core and plan on starting in the spring. So now I'm going to switch gears and give you what I call the whirlwind tour of a complex remedial site, the St. Louis River Interlake Duluth Tar Site, and what the remedy construction activities were, how that site was cleaned up. And Jim Payne spoke to this in his talk this morning about we had a collaborative effort, and really, first of all, I guess the extent of contamination is three embayments in the river from a Interlake Iron and their coking operations. So the coal tars from the coking operations were discharged directly to the river. Any place in red here exceeded our cleanup goal. The darker reds are just thicknesses of contamination in the estuary. And it was up to 14 or 15 feet thick in some areas. But as Jim said, we needed to clean this up. There was some real bad environmental problems. Stryker Bay would bloom with oil every summer. And I'm going to walk through it. We figured out that the best approach was a combination remedy. It wasn't just an all dredge or an all cap remedy. And we came to that conclusion through a fairly lengthy process of peer review and stakeholder involvement. So what happened there in 2006, the first element was Stryker Bay cap and surcharge construction. So part of Stryker Bay was slated to be capped in place, and it was capped rather than dredged because there was some really high-level naphthalene and pretty bad contamination. Or if you dredged it, there's a neighborhood nearby. There are real potential issues with exposures to levels of PAHs and naphthalene in the air. So we looked at, okay, how are we going to take a 3 to 5 foot bay, put a 4 foot remedial cap on it, and still end up with a 3 to 5 foot bay when we're done? Good trick, but one of the ideas that came out of that peer group that Jim spoke about earlier today was a technique called a surcharge cap. So there are really high water content sediments, native sediments, below the contamination in this area that was slated to be done with this technique that are very compressible through seepage-induced consolidation. So you, as you move the pore water out, you consolidate that material and sink it down. So what you do is we cordoned off the area with sheet pile wall, so we had that whole area isolated, and then came in with a capping spreader barge. And this is just a method to get the cap material in with lower energy in a slurry form, because this is real soft sediment. We didn't want to mix it with the cap, and we didn't want it to displace the mud and create mud waves and cap failures. So the trick was to feed it at a rate that was computer controlled, that towed this barge along on these traces to get a consistent 6-inch lift of sand on your soft sediment with as little energy as possible. And the cores that were taken to show that showed that we were able to achieve a very consistent 6-inch lift with virtually no mixing of soft sediments. So once that was done, because they were going to consolidate this and the seepage pore water from consolidation has to go someplace, it goes all directions, but a lot of it goes up, and we didn't want to recontaminate our cap with that pore water. So a geotextile woven or a activated carbon-filled mat was placed in as a reactive layer in the cap. It was put on roller barges and deployed on top of that first lift of cap material. These were actually manufactured in Germany and transported over here by ship directly to the site. Each one was about 80 to 100 feet long and 28 feet wide, and they rolled them out in place. And here's a deployment map that shows basically how you carpet about 14 acres of bay. And then you come back in with the spreader barge, build stability, build your cap in the water, and then start working above ground by placing your final cap material and the surcharge. So the cap is 4 feet thick. We put an additional up to 10 feet of sand on here just for weight to do the surcharging. Had to put in tiebacks and deadmen to give stability to that wall during that process. And there it was done, and it has to sit for about 3 years to achieve its desired consolidation. All that material that's used as that extra weight is going to be used for capping other parts of the site. So the other thing that happened in the first year in 2006 of a 5-year implementation was a end dike was constructed on Slip 6, which is our confined aquatic disposal facility for any dredge sediment. So the dike was built with crane barges, pretty robust dike. Clay mat and ballast was installed to keep pore water from moving out during the filling process. And that was pretty much the end of the first year of construction. 2007 was our main dredging year in Stryker Bay. Before we could dredge, we cordoned off the bay with water-filled dams and a weir wall to control water and isolate it from the estuary. And then we had vegetation removal in the first of several appearances of our fish herders who would use a copper sulfate solution and work from back to our opening and herd the fish out of the bay. It was a requirement of the DNR's permit. Kind of an interesting process, and the fish were really pouring out of there. The dredge that was selected for this project was a mechanical hybrid, a hydraulic hybrid dredge. There was advantages to both mechanical and hybrid dredging, but for this site, it was a basically an excavator with a hydraulically actuated clamshell bucket on the bottom on a couple flexi-float barges. And then we brought makeup water in from our CAD to create a slurry of the dredge material and pump that to our storage facility. Here's the picture of the dredge in operation. It would pick it up, move it into this hopper over here, which would then make it up into a slurry and pump it at about 8% solids to the CAD. And then we would return water from the CAD so we could lessen our water budget and do less water treatment for that makeup water. The bucket was specially designed to be relatively level cut, has relief valves as it's being pushed into the sediment, and has gussets on the side to keep the contaminants from spilling out and lessen residual. And then it was pumped hydraulically to our CAD to a tremie barge. And the tremie pipe was pushed down to the bottom with a specially designed diffuser to take the energy out of it and create less suspended solids, which would mean less water treatment in the end, and get an even lift on the bottom of our CAD. Dredging was a 24/7 operation, and there was about 260, I forget exactly, 1,000 yards dredged into the CAD. After you dredge, you've got to deal with dredge residual. It's not a really clean process. You're getting the majority of the contaminants out, but there's going to be residual left over. To address that, we put a foot of sand on top to both dilute that and allow for degradation. And that's placed by another spreader barge similar to the other one that was used. In 2008, we dredged the Wisconsin and Navigational Channel. Part of the site is actually in Wisconsin. And that was in about 28 feet of water, so we had to use a crane barge, but we did the same makeup water and slurry transport as in Stryker Bay. Then there was land-based and water-based capping in Keene Creek Bay and Slip 7. Again, another version of the spreader barge with a couple guys on there with a drop core, kind of checking their thickness as they go. And then when you got to areas where there were shallow flats, you couldn't operate a barge. It was land-based capping, and they would put the lifts on and lay the cap down with long stick excavators. And there was a root barrier in this portion of the cap. It was not as thick of a cap, so we wanted to prevent deep-rooting wetland and terrestrial plants from getting into the contaminated zone. So that actually placed about created about 11 acres of land that had to be mitigated for the loss of open water. And once you place all these caps in place, you want them to stay there. It's a pretty dynamic system, so we had a fairly sophisticated armoring plan with different types and sizes of armor materials for different energy regimes, prop wash, sash, current, waves, to protect the remedy that was placed in place or put in place. So there were various methods and means and places where they had to armor the caps. In 2009 is when we got to the point where did it work? We removed the sheet pile wall from that portion of Stryker Bay, and that was done by just removing the surcharge that was now going to be used to cap the CAD. And so it was transported over there, away from the sheet pile. You get a hard hat diver to go in on the deep side, torch it off, cut it up in sections, and remove it. And then we covered over the remaining buried sheet pile wall that creates a physical barrier between the dredged area and the capped area. Then they surveyed the final cap elevation to ensure that we had 4 feet of remedial cap and removed the surcharge material. So we ended up with a bay again. It worked pretty well. There are some areas that are shallower than predicted. There are some areas that are deeper than predicted. But in general, it has the qualities of a shallow sheltered bay, even though we put 4 feet of cap on a basically 4 foot deep bay. We completed armoring in some of the areas that needed protection. And this is what kind of the new land created in the shallow flats looks like. There were a couple of wetlands that were on the peninsula that needed to be dredged to a defined elevation and then capped so we could rehabilitate those wetlands and restore those. So 2010, the final cap CAD was put in place. Again, there was a carbon mat that was put in here. This wasn't actually part of the original remedy, but the RPs went to the Great Lakes National Program Office at EPA, and they got Legacy Act funding to have a betterment to the remedy to put this in for that consolidation that's going to happen in the CAD and the poor water movement. Again, that was placed, and then final CAD capping with another version of the spreader barge. And then the end dike was removed to reintegrate it with the river. So now it's open to the river, and it's about 3 to 5 feet deep, and people use it. I've kayaked in there multiple times, and it's really doing good for a restoration. Last thing we did was take environmental media pumped from a Talus Island mitigation project into Stryker Bay. All of our caps and post-dredge covers were sand. It's not the best substrate for a shallow sheltered bay recovery. So the dredged area from about a mile away where they dredged mud was brought over and placed around the site. Here's a deployment plot of that to jumpstart the ecological recovery and get a good substrate, and also had a good seed stock for the native aquatic plants. There was all our land areas and buffer strips and conservation easements placed and lots, about 3,500 shrubs and trees planted. So that was the whirlwind tour of a complex sediment remedy that took place and has been completed and is actually performing very well and looks really good right now. So I'm going to move 3 miles upriver to the big brother of Interlake, U.S. Steel. And as Nelson mentioned, this is one of the big areas that is a beneficial use impairment on the river. And we're at the point now where originally U.S. Steel was slated as a natural recovery remedy in the official ROD. A couple of five-year reviews and a lot of sampling information and a lot of oil blooms later, it's not performing. So we're going to do a sediment remedy here in a number of areas. Again, it's about 3 miles upriver. Interlake was right here. Here's U.S. Steel. It's site boundaries, about 550 acres of land, another 300 acres in our estuary study zone. Real brief history. It operated from 1915 to 1979. There are a few lingering operations that went into the early 80s. All of the infrastructure is gone now. Steel and coke production was disposed to the St. Louis River through tributaries and streams. It was listed on the NPL site for Superfund in 1983 with the Interlake site. They actually combined them for the NPL listing. The contaminants are pHs mainly and heavy metals in soil, sediment, surface water, and groundwater at the site. This is an area we call, I'm just going to talk about the sediments, and we call these the upland sediments, or the creek corridors. So there's this corridor, which used to be a stream that they used as a settling basin. Then there's an old embayment of the river that was used as a another settling pond. A couple other little ponds and tar pits that are being handled under this remedy. Coke plant settling area was really what they did is they took a built a weir and controlled the elevation of this so they could use it as a disposal lagoon. And all of the material from the hot side of the steel making process and the coke ovens went directly into this. So it was a real mess. This shows the same picture Nelson showed earlier where material came down through that and created this large delta, which the original shoreline used to be about like this. So all this material came from this settling basin. And it's about 17 feet thick in its thickest portions and is pretty highly contaminated. Just to the south was the wire mill pond and settling basin. That encompasses this area. You can see the wire mill in the background. Again, this was a waste lagoon. And as we've talked about all throughout today, this was done, these are 1967 air photos, this was done under a permit. So it was something that was regular practice. So when that would fill up, they would sidecast it into the open waters and wetlands around the edge, creating some pretty thick sequences of contaminated sediment inside the railroad tracks that have now closed off that bay. The estuary itself, there's were discharges from both of those on-land tributaries, and they contaminated the sediments out in the estuary. This just shows various benchmarks. The black line is really surrounds the areas that exceed our cleanup goals for sediments. And I'll shade them in so it looks a little easier to see. So those are the areas of the estuary that need a remedy. Put it on, transfer it to an air photo, and then you can see how they interface with the on-land areas. So these areas total about 1.6 to 1.7 million cubic yards of contaminated sediment above a cleanup goal. It's a lot of material. How much is that? How do you describe that to people? We had a little challenge of how do you get that to the public. Most of you know the MPCA building, six-story rectangle. A lot of you know it really well. Well, it would fill that volume quite a few times, actually. Not just once, but it would fill that volume about 30 times. So it's just a kind of a way to get a little bit of a better handle on how much sediment we're dealing with and how that affects cost. So it's a lot. That's all you really need to know. It's a lot. U.S. Steel contaminated sediments are the largest point source of contaminated sediment-related beneficial use impairments in the St. Louis River AOC, upwards of 650,000 yards in the estuary itself, plus the million that in the other areas of the site. So we've had these partnerships talked a little bit about. In 2011, GLIMPO partnered EPA's Great Lakes National Program Office. GLIMPO has partnered with U.S. Steel. Legacy Act funding, Great Lakes Legacy Act funding allows GLIMPO to partner with responsible parties for investigation, design, and cleanup of these sites. Even though, because this site had an original ROD, if it's under an enforcement document, they can't do it. But the original ROD on this one hasn't been amended yet and was a no action ROD or a natural recovery ROD. They're able to partner with them and are paying for various things somewhere around 40 to 50% of the costs. So it's a great, it really got things moving at this site. We also partnered with Army Corps of Engineers to characterize Spirit Lake, which was part of our characterization, which helped get additional data to select remedies here. So our estimated schedule, the feasibility study, we're promised a draft, near-final draft that we've been working on collaboratively with U.S. Steel and their consultants, BAR, tomorrow. And it'll be finalized in December. We hope to have a proposed plan put together December-January timeframe. We'll go to public comment in January, hopefully. The design and permits portion, design has already started preliminarily. We'll go through June. and if all goes right, be in the water in May of 2015 for a 2 to 3 year remedy implementation. And with that, I'm going to turn it back to Nelson.
Thanks, Mike.
Let's see how this
amazing stories, aren't they? I mean, it's just amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. I mean, one thing this tells me, you know, coming into this, I hadn't realized, but I kind of put it all together. I mean, one would have to ask, why was John Blotnick from Duluth the chief House author of the Clean Water Act back in 1971-72? I think I know why. Why was Jim Oberstar so hugely involved in Clean Water Act related activities? It's because their community was hugely affected by things that were done prior to the establishment of those types of regulations. Also, I think I was going to mention, I forgot to, but Mike has raised the Great Lakes Legacy Act, which, again, Jim Oberstar was the chief house author of the Great Lakes Legacy Act. That was an expression by Congress that the cleanup and the remedy of sites in the Great Lakes was not proceeding at a pace that they thought would be desirable to essentially get the outcomes that were desired. In other words, Superfund, for whatever reason, was not moving at a pace that got to solutions soon enough. And how exciting it is to see the 2017-2018 deadline for the U.S. Steel Superfund site in the AOC after all these years, given that it was listed in 1983, the same year that MRLA was signed. So very exciting to see this all come together. And with that, that sort of gets at the perfect storm that we have going on here. And I think the Legacy Act in the Great Lakes is something that Congress is really pushing because they want to see these areas of concern cleaned up. So the spirit of collaboration and partnerships and working together to get outcomes, rather than continuing to poke each other in the eye with a sharp stick, just for the sake of doing that, it's really the outcomes we're after, and we should not spend a lot more time, chasing each other's tails, whether you're the RP or the regulatory party, but really focus on getting outcomes. So the perfect storm we're in right now is that we have developed a remedial action plan after a 3-year process involving over 75 stakeholders. The characterization work that Mike described is part of a 600-plus page appendix to that plan, which is some of the deep science behind the plan. The plan was developed. It's inclusive, had community engagement as well as agency and tribal nation engagement. It's comprehensive and targeted. We identified 60 specific actions that we believe need to be done in the next 8 to 10 years to remove those 9 impairments that I ever so lightly covered earlier on and formally delist the area of concern by removing each one of those 9 impairments. So there's a fairly detailed process by which our team has set up a strategic business plan, for lack of a better term, to get that work done. It's aggressive. Our timeline is we want to get this done. We have 26 restoration and remediation sites. Some of them slip, some of them at the scale of U.S. Steel. The goal is to get all of the construction work done in those sites, both in Minnesota and Wisconsin, by 2020. That's the challenge and the opportunity ahead of us. And the federal partners and our state partners and the Great Lakes Legacy Act partners are starting to step up and bring the resources to bear to get that work done. It's very exciting, but it's a very aggressive timeline, as you can see from Mike's description of the SLRIDT site, which was a five-year effort. So we know that we can do it, but we're going to do that 6 or 7 or 8 times over, I think. And I know we focused a lot on the remediation today for all the right reasons, but there is a restoration component to the yellow sites that that will become apparent on the map that I will show here shortly. And obviously, this effort is timely. The money is here. We have the State Minnesota Legacy Act, which has already put in between the Outdoor Heritage Fund and the Clean Water Fund over $8 million in the last 4 years, which has leveraged about $25 or $26 million of federal money and the $2.1 million that U.S. Steel currently has on the table as part of the remedial investigation and feasibility study work at U.S. Steel. So it's a wonderful time to be doing this work. Let's see, I think I hit the wrong one here. Oops, what did I do here? There we go. So this is the map that sort of shows, this is just the pointer here. Yeah. This map shows the suite of sites that we're actions that we're looking at. There are a couple of watershed-wide areas like the Nemadji River watershed, and this is Crawford Creek here. That's primarily a Superfund site there or a remedial site in Wisconsin. But essentially, the color coding here is that the remediation sites that are known right now are the red sites here. The sampling is currently underway at the red-gray sites. And then aquatic habitat, shallow bay aquatic habitat restoration is occurring at these brown tone sites. To get this work done, we have received partnership agreement funding from the Corps of Engineers to essentially complete fully designed construction bid estimate designs for all of the restoration sites on the Minnesota side of the AOC. And we will see that work culminating in between next spring and next fall, and the field season work will begin in earnest in 2016 through 2020 on those restoration sites. A very unique partnership agreement has arisen there, which is the Army Corps of Engineers does navigational dredging in the harbor. That's part of what they do. But they always need to find places to put the material. Our agency, working with EPA and the Army Corps of Engineers and other parties, it has developed a protocol for testing those navigational dredge materials, determining whether they are clean enough to put back in the water. And we have a pilot project that's in year two, you're going into year three, where we're essentially using the Army Corps of Engineers dredge material, which they are dredging under the Harbor Maintenance Trust Fund, and they are then placing those materials according to the preliminary designs we have for the restoration sites. So it's a true win-win scenario where one federal agency is helping another federal agency achieve its goals. And we plan to do that over the course of the next 6 years, and only do so with material that tests out appropriately. In addition, our work is, so the Corps of Engineers in this location is in a very unusual position of not having enough material to meet our needs in the time that we need it. So this is a place where they don't have enough dredge material to place. So they're not looking for a place, we're looking for more material. There are mechanisms by which we can do that, and we've estimated our needs are about 1.5 million cubic yards of material to recreate these shallow bay habitat sites. They can provide 100,000 cubic yards a year, so if we take the five-year estimate, 500,000 of the 1.5 million would come from navigational dredging at no additional cost to the taxpayers, and we're now working on how to fund with federal GLRI money and possibly some other sources the movement of the remaining 1 million cubic yards to get the habitat restoration done. Is that making sense? And it is sort of a metaphor for what the Great Lakes Collaborative and Initiative is about, which is getting federal agencies and local and state partners working better together on more cost-efficient and effective outcomes. This one's too busy for you to look at, but this is just a reflection of those restoration and remediation site activities and a tracking. You can see the green indicates that we've essentially started work on all of these sites and all of these actions, and the purple is showing how the percentage of completion that we are on those sites. Bottom line is that we have a lot of work ahead of us. The total cost estimate comes in around at the $150 to $250 million level, but what we're finding as we move into the actual design work and discussions, we're finding ways to trim off costs and make things happen through more cost-effective means. But it's a huge project and driven by the fact that we have target dates by which we would like to get these 9 impairments removed. So the exciting news for our team this year, which may have escaped you because I'm not sure it made the headlines down here, was that a year earlier than predicted, we removed our first impairment, which was the softest of the impairments, the aesthetics, degradation of aesthetics. But nonetheless, it shows that we're making progress and we have a can-do attitude that we can get this plan completed. So with that, I always go to my friend, Mr. Bob Dillon, who actually performed last summer in the AOC at Bayfront Park, and I almost got him to say this. He mumbled something. I think he's mumbled this. He said, "We're not just going to sit here and watch the river flow. We're going to get it delisted." So we're on a pathway. We know that's what he said, right? And he's a hometown boy. He grew up in the St. Louis River watershed. So But we'd be able to stand for any questions, comments, observations, so we really appreciate the opportunity to talk about this big-scale project, and it's so exciting to see it all come together. Thank you all.
Ian, we've been discussing the St. Louis River. I'd just like to announce that the Red Cliff Tribe in Wisconsin is having a Great Lakes Bi-National Forum this Friday at 12:30. You don't have to be pre-registered. Karen Diver from our own Fond du Lac Tribe in Duluth will be one of the speakers. We'll probably hear some more about the St. Louis River and probably groundwater. Thank you.
What's the nature of the aquatic restoration? Why do you need the sediment to... What's being restored? I missed something. I probably missed something.
Well, we went fast over this. So the bottom line is that if we look at the alteration to the system that occurred starting 150 years ago and continuing through essentially the mid of last century, the alteration was dredging wetland habitat to create deeper places or filling wetland habitat to create shallower places or the land on which you would essentially creating the slips, basically. So that is the functional alteration that happened. The team that came together and developed the plan decided to set a goal of restoring 1,700 acres of shallow bay aquatic habitat as the goal for replacing the function of the ecosystem that was lost through those earlier alterations. So that's the target. It's related to replacing 1,700 acres of shallow bay aquatic habitat.
And is some of that habitat restoration in conjunction with the same place as the capping of contaminated sediments, or are those two different things?
Those are two different things. Thus the reason for the map that shows the red sites. The slips are, I think, and all that might jump in too, but the sense is that there will be biological goals associated with those, I'm assuming, but it's not for the purpose of restoring the habitat. That's not the primary purpose. Those linear walls in the slips are going to say straight and rectangular, which, as I understand it, is not the best for habitat. And so thus, we've identified those brown tone or yellow tone zones where the restoration is going to occur, and the remediation will occur. The two places where they do hybridize, I guess, are U.S. Steel and Mud Lake, primarily. So, Mike?
Yeah, the primary reason for doing the cleanups under Superfund is to remove risks to human and ecological receptors. And since these sites do have some human risks, they're mainly driven by ecological receptors, the benthic community and higher trophic levels, as that is the base of the food chain. We are incorporating some major elements of restoration into the remedy. And the reason for that is the collaborative process, again, that Jim mentioned earlier, where we have the resource managers at the table for determining what remedy is acceptable at U.S. Steel. So we're incorporating some major resource elements to that, creating a shallow sheltered bay habitat out of a number of the options that are in the feasibility study. So they will be part of it. And also the reason for that is when the EPA, Great Lakes National Program Office, and Legacy Act funds are funding this, they want a betterment to the remedy. And the betterment in this case is ecological habitat.
All right, quick question, going back to the Corps of Engineers. And what is the Corps going to do with the dredge spoils they have, say, 10 years from now? Are you going to have any long-term maintenance for your remediated areas where you have subsidence and you'd need to fill that back in?
I can't predict the future, but what I know has happened is the paradigm has shifted from similar to RPs and the regulating parties poking each other in the eye and not getting progress. You know, the agencies would not permit the Corps to put material in the water. And the Corps would always say, we want to dump it out in the lake. And the agencies in Minnesota and Wisconsin say, no, there's no reason to do that. Why? So what we've now developed is a process by which we can take a look at these materials and find out if there's some ecological restoration or other higher purpose that can be used, they can be used for. I should say that, something that happened about a decade ago or 8 years ago was Erie Pier, which is was a confined disposal facility in the estuary, has morphed into a recycling facility. So in that case, the material is being tested for the SRV values, and material that it's not contaminated is now available to be used on land for highway construction, golf course spreading, and things like that. So what's happening is we're opening the box for some creative alternative uses of these materials. Now, will that guarantee no need for a future disposal facility? We don't know the answer to that. But we do know that the DNR and other agencies have sights on doing restoration work above and beyond the work that's called for in this remedial action plan. Because remember, this work is tied to the goal of taking care of those historic legacy impacts. There is going to be future work for further restoration out in the future. So we may be helping to set the course for constructive use of that material. In addition, there are discussions going on, and there have been pilots with the mines, to the extent that the mines need material to do mine land reclamation or things like that. Those are things that the Port Authority and other people are working on to see if that's a market that will be sustainable over the long term. And if there are other mines developed and other material is needed, I guess I'm just a simple guy from Hibbing. If trains are coming down full and going home empty, maybe they could go back with some of the navigational dredge materials. But those are issues that those parties have to work out. Does that help?
One last question goes to Kelton Barr.
Okay. Where is Kelton?
Is this on?
Yeah.
It's just like the old swimming meets, Kelton.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So is there a TMDL for sediment for the St. Louis River? Is that one of the long-term remedies, is to cut down on the sediment coming down the river?
Actually, there is there is not a sediment impairment that I'm aware of, and I'm not the guy to speak directly to that. But there is a sediment and nutrient beneficial use impairment. And we have work going on right now to determine whether the sediments and nutrients have been adequately managed in the St. Louis River. The early indication is, and we've got folks from the Med Lab, from EPA and others working on this, is that we have probably achieved the goals established with the impacts that were discussed in the sediment and nutrient BUI. UN Revy is doing some paleoecological work for us right now, and we're gathering all kinds of information to make that case. So right now, obviously when you have floods like the 2012 event, there's sediment coming down the system. But in general, we don't think that there's a significant problem there.
Very cool stuff. Keep the Sinkhole Conference on your radar screen. Lanya Ross is going to be your president next year. Stand up and be recognized. And thank you all for coming.